Hello, NSA. I just called you to say I love you because you really listen. Now when I'm on the phone, will I never feel alone? 'Cause you're out there with your headphones and you really listen. I know you'll take my call, 'cause you care enough to take them all. And you're fighting freedom here at home, so we don't have to fight it over there. Now my own sweet Marie never listens to me. I can't even get through to my mama, but you listen so well to the secrets I tell. Guess that's how Obama caught Osama. NSA, listen please while I order extra cheese. I love you 'cause you're out there. Here's how I know. Not a stain on a dress, but a leak nonetheless tells me so. So hello.
Hello and welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Today's program starts out with a short piece about the unknown knowns. John Gray reflects on what we know but prefer not to think about, whether it's the truth about the invasion of Iraq or the failures of the financial system that led to the banking crisis. And then after that, on to the main part of the program, Rachel Levinson-Wallman talks to Scott Horton. Rachel Levinson-Wallman is the counsel to the Brennan Center Liberty and National Security Program and discusses what the government does with Americans' data and how the fusion centers have quickly expanded their focus from terrorism to all manner of criminal activity. Rachel asks whether the public backlash can dial back the government's excessive power. And then after that, a short piece on the just 90 firms that have tipped the climate. A recent study has found that the number of state and investor-owned organizations responsible for the human impact of global warming is smaller than you might think. And then after that, another short piece on the West Coast Action Plan on Climate and Energy. U.S. states of California, Oregon, and Washington and the Canadian province of British Columbia have signed a pact to reduce carbon dioxide emissions by putting a price on carbon. British Columbia's Environmental Minister, Mary Olat, discusses the agreement and how a carbon tax is working in the province with Steve Curwood.
The speaker is John Gray.
We'd like to think the financial crisis is safely in the past. The events of 2007, 2008, when the world's banking system was on the brink of collapse, seemed like a once-in-a-century upheaval, and it's natural to imagine we've returned to some kind of normalcy. Disaster has been averted, and there may be some signs of recovery in the economy. But have we emerged onto a sunny upland of stability, or are we fooling ourselves? History suggests an upheaval on this scale isn't left behind so easily. Could it be that we know the crisis hasn't been resolved, but prefer not to think about the fact? Former American Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld's distinction between known unknowns and unknown unknowns has passed into everyday speech. It's not the things of which we know we're ignorant that we should worry about, he pointed out. It's the things we're unaware of not knowing that can really cause trouble. It's a useful reminder of the vastness of human ignorance. But might there not be another kind of unknown, which Rumsfeld didn't mention, one that consists of things we choose not to know? Looking back, the purpose of Rumsfeld's distinction may have been to lay the ground for the invasion of Iraq that followed just over a year later. Saddam's supposed weapons of mass destruction were the main justification for the war. As we now know, he had no such capability at the time of the invasion. He'd used chemical weapons in the past, in the war with Iran in the 80s, and later in attacks on the Kurds, for example. But as American-led forces found when they searched the country, any WMD programs that had existed had long since been abandoned. Even at the time of Rumsfeld's remark, there were good reasons to doubt Saddam was supplying terrorists with weapons. The fact that Saddam had kept Al-Qaeda out of Iraq was well known to diplomats, military strategists, and security experts. Possibly this is why, when asked if the link between Saddam and terrorism was an unknown unknown, Rumsfeld replied, "I'm not going to say which it is." Anyone with a little knowledge of history understood that Saddam was unlikely to be in league with Al-Qaeda. But for those who launched the war, the history of the country they were planning to invade was irrelevant. Partly this came from a misplaced sense of invincibility. Many 20th century wars ended with massively superior forces being obliged to accept defeat. Think of the French in Algeria or the Americans in Vietnam. Despite this record, few, if any, of those who supported the invasion considered the possibility of a long drawn-out conflict. They believed that once Saddam's forces had been defeated, the whole country would unite in welcoming the occupiers and setting up an American-style democracy. Yet 80 years before the war, the British civil servant, who as much as anyone created the state of Iraq, knew it could never be democratic. Cobbled together from a former province of the Ottoman Empire in the early 1920s, the state was, to a large extent, the work of a single British official, a remarkable woman, the first to have a senior position in the colonial service, called Gertrude Bell. A fluent speaker of the languages of the region and widely respected by its rulers and peoples, she recognised that because power had been placed in the hands of the Sunni minority, any move to majority rule would mean intense and protracted sectarian warfare, along with the secession of the Kurds. Bell foresaw the chaos that was bound to ensue if there was ever any attempt at democratic regime change. She wouldn't have been surprised when the National Museum of Antiquities, which she'd founded as a tribute to a civilization she admired, was looted soon after the American-led invasion. Dying in 1926, Bell chose to be buried in the British cemetery in Baghdad, which was also vandalized at the time of the invasion. When he heard of the looting, Rumsfeld's only comment was, "Stuff happens." Insignificant events of this sort, he implied, couldn't upset the grand plan that lay behind the war. Much has been alleged about disinformation in the run-up to the invasion. But if some of those who launched the war were presenting a distorted picture of the facts, they were also deceiving themselves. Contrary to a common view, it wasn't that Rumsfeld and his fellow war planners failed to prepare for the situation that would come about in the country after the invasion. If they'd known the chaos and conflict that would follow, they might not have been able to launch the war. So rather than confront the facts, they chose to remain ignorant of them. For Rumsfeld and others who thought like him, the risks of the invasion weren't unknown unknowns. They belonged in another category of human ignorance, that of unknown knowns, things they decided weren't worth thinking about. It's an attitude that hasn't gone away. A similar denial of reality prevails today in Britain and many other countries in connection with the financial crisis and its aftermath. The bankers and politicians seem genuinely to have believed that a new type of capitalism had been invented, in which booms and busts would no longer occur. In the new era we'd entered, they were convinced, a level of prosperity had been reached that would only increase for the foreseeable future. Again, anyone with a passing acquaintance with history would have known that this had been believed many times in the past, and always mistakenly. Only days before the 1929 stock market crash, one of the best-known economists of the time, Professor Irving Fisher of Yale University, announced that stock prices have reached what looks like a permanently high plateau. Even after the crash occurred, Fisher insisted it was only a market correction that would soon be over. Losing most of his own fortune, the distinguished economist was as deluded as nearly everyone else. In case you're wondering who anticipated the crash, two who did were the mobster Al Capone, who described the stock market in the boom years as a racket, and Charlie Chaplin, who unsuccessfully pleaded with his friend, the songwriter Irving Berlin, to sell out the day before the market collapsed. A Great Depression of the kind that followed the crash of 1929 has been avoided. but we've not returned to anything like stability. Near zero interest rates have led to the near impossibility of saving, along with a bubble in the stock market and house prices. It's an abnormal state of affairs that can't last. It wouldn't take much to trigger another upset, a worsening in the European situation, or a faster than expected slowdown in China, for example. But that's an unnerving prospect, so we've decided not to think about it. The acute fragility of our economic system is just one of many facts we all know, but have decided not to think about. Some people suggest this refusal to think is produced by the system itself. It's the only way our current economic and political arrangements can keep on going. This may be so, but the resolute avoidance of unsettling facts is a deep-seated human trait. While we live surrounded by unknown unknowns, we live on the basis of unknown knowns, intractable facts that we prefer to forget. We'd do better to confront these awkward realities and muddle through more intelligently. We humans are sturdy and resilient animals with enormous capacities of creativity and adaptability, but consistently realistic thinking seems to be beyond our powers. This may well be the biggest unknown known of them all. In an age that prides itself on its advancing knowledge and superior understanding, we're as anxious as ever to avoid facing up to our actual condition.
Hi, I'm Steve Lerman. I'm the guy that produces, edits, narrates, and promotes Great Speeches and Interviews. I'm the guy responsible for airing in-depth interviews, speeches, and even debates on controversial subjects such as war and peace and climate change and the economy. I hope you like listening to it as much as I like producing it. Access Sacramento broadcasts it on the internet every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. And you can find the podcast at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com as well as at Facebook.
Reports find the patterns sifting through. As he read the data, the patterns did emerge. Patterns that were clear both before and since the surge. Patterns of abuse of the most horrific kind. Gunning down civilians out of view and out of mind. Gunning down the opposition in the middle of the night. Sending off the scholars to be tortured out of sight. Sometimes you need desperate measures when you live in desperate times. Private Manning's all he was, looking at war crimes. He wondered what to do to allow the dead to speak. He finally decided to contact WikiLeaks. Now it's all out on the table and everybody knows. The emperor is naked, he's not wearing. He stabbed Bradley in the back, called the cops and turned him in. But not before the soldier took half a million files. If you printed all the pages, they'd stretch on for miles. Evidence against the state, right from the horse's mouth. Machinations in the west, bombings in the south. A treasure trove of details for all the globe to see. How much they need to lie and kill for democracy. How many drone strikes have hit villages, leaving everyone to die. They blamed on someone else, the official line, not I. How many coups have been plotted by ambassadors who say that free and fair elections be the order of the day? Now it's all out on the table and everybody knows. The emperor is naked, he's not wearing any clothes. And they're trying to stuff it back and stop it from illuminating everything we lack, such as the rule of law or playing by the book. Look, you can read it, it's right here. The ship of state is run by crooks, and they vilify the messengers, call them every name for daring to blow the whistle on the nature of their game, the game of terror. taking lives and endangering the rest in order for the wealthy few to do what they do best. Dominate the world for the corporate elite, but now their cover's blown from their head down to their feet. And now the Stars and Stripes is looking much more like a rag. The lid is off the box, the cat's out of the bag. Now it's all out on the table and everybody knows. The Emperor is naked, he's not wearing any clothes. It's all out on the table and everybody knows. The Emperor is naked, he's not wearing any clothes.
I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And our first guest today is Rachel Levinson Waldman. She is counsel to the Brennan Center's Liberty and National Security Program. That's the Brennan Center at the New York University School of Law. And she's got a whole bunch of stuff that needs reviewing here. First and foremost, what the government does with Americans' data. Welcome to the show. How are you doing, Rachel?
Good. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you very much for joining us. I'm very happy to have you here. And I admit, I did not budget my time well, and I had to quit about halfway through this thing this morning before the show.
Understood.
But
it's long.
It was so good that it's one of the very small percentages of things that I'm going to, I swear, finish even after the interview's over. Because it's really good, and I really need a thorough understanding of this. So I can teach it myself as best I can, and it's all such a complicated thing. But anyway, so I want to start the interview with pretty much the same way that the study starts off with, is reviewing a little bit of the history of Nixon era and really J. Edgar Hoover era abuses and what happened, the pushback from that in the 1970s, and then, of course, you know, how that pushback has become undone, basically, since September 11th and the steps that have been taken, where, in other words, where we are now on the slippery slope compared to then and that kind of thing.
Sure, yeah. So do you want me to start out just sort of talking about the history, where some of this stuff came from?
Yeah, sure.
Sure. So to give a little background for your listeners on the report overall, what I talk about in the report is, as you say, what the government is doing with Americans' data. And what I mean when I say that is specifically, what is the government doing with non-criminal information about Americans that it's gathering? The idea being that post 9/11, the government has much more authority, was given much more legal authority, it's interpreted the legal authority that it has fairly broadly to allow it to connect, to allow it to collect a lot of information that's not necessarily connected to, you know, suspicion of criminal activity or a very specific, you know, national security threat. And so the way I start off this report, as you say, is looking at the history, kind of how did we get to this point? And it's, I think it's impossible to understand both what's happening now and the significance of it without understanding the sort of 1960s, 1970s era abuses and then reforms. So what we learned about from the Church Committee, of course, this was the Senate Committee. Senator Frank Church was the head of it, and this was put into place to find out basically what had J. Edgar Hoover been doing at the FBI, what had the CIA been doing, what had the NSA been doing. And in 1976, the Church Committee released this amazing, thousands of pages long report saying there had really been significant abuses across the board. So the FBI had been engaged in targeting women's liberation movements, black student unions, Martin Luther King Jr., a whole variety of domestic kind of political activism and social activism movements. And they found the same at the CIA and the NSA. So the CIA also was infiltrating, you know, protest movements, various domestic groups. The CIA at one point was taking and reading every single foreign telegraph that was leaving from the United States that Americans were sending overseas. The NSA was looking at the content of every single one of these. And so across these agencies, they were taking in information about thousands of Americans who weren't doing anything wrong, who were just engaged in a variety of activities. And by and large, these programs for all of them started fairly modestly. You know, they had fairly modest goals, but this was happening in secret. It was at a time where there was this incredible fear of communism. And so their activities just kind of grew and grew and grew, and the powers that they'd taken grew and grew and grew. So the church committee releases this report. It's a huge issue. And in response, there are a variety of protections put into place. So just before the church committee report, Congress passed something called the Privacy Act, which was meant to protect a lot of personal information about Americans and give Americans the right to find out what information about them do federal agencies have. Then after that, there were restrictions put into place on what the FBI could do domestically. There was something called the Attorney General's Guidelines that the Attorney General at the time put into place. And then something that, you know, for better or worse, you and your listeners might be becoming more and more familiar with, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which put much more court oversight, basically, over kind of national security and foreign intelligence work that the NSA and the FBI do. And so that was what was in place up until 9/11. Certainly with changes, and we can get into more of the details of that, but there were these basic protections in place, and there was kind of a basic understanding that generally First Amendment protected activity would be protected. So, you know, speech, association, things like that got heightened protection. There was this judicial review over a variety of things, and that people couldn't be targeted, generally didn't have foreign intelligence investigations opened on them or information gathered unless they themselves were an agent of a foreign power, things like that was fairly restricted. After 9/11, really, the floodgates opened. You know, there was this feeling there had been this horrific attack that had been missed. And so kind of on all levels, the Patriot Act was passed. That made changes across the board. The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act was amended in a number of different ways. And so what you started to see was a lot more information coming in about Americans that wasn't necessarily connected to somebody acting on behalf of a foreign power or somebody engaging in criminal activity. And so then what we were interested in is what happens next? What happens to all of that information that's been brought in?
Right. Okay, now, so to rewind to the Bush Jr. years here just a minute, how far with Stellar Wind and the rest of what they were doing in secret up until the New York Times finally exposed it in 2005, how much further were they going beyond FISA, beyond the Patriot Act?
Well, this is one of the interesting things. So with those programs, things like warrantless wiretapping, all of these things that were being undertaken in secret for the 4 or 5 years after 9/11, they were certainly going beyond what the law allowed at the time. I think that was pretty clear that it was in violation of what the law allowed. That being said, when that information was revealed, as you say, the New York Times article in 2005, the public suddenly starts to learn much more about what the government has been doing in secret. By and large, kind of the changes, the statutory revisions that were made in response to that were simply to, by and large, allow the government to continue doing the same things, but write it into law. Mm-hmm. And so what we see now is, in a lot of ways, even an expansion of the ways in which the law was changed just after 9/11 to allow then what Bush II kind of did to push those laws even more. Mm-hmm.
I can ride my bike with no handlebars, no handlebars, no handlebars. I can ride my bike with no handlebars, no handlebars, no handlebars. Look at me, look at me, hands in the air like it's good to be alive. And I'm a famous rapper even when the paths are all crooked-y. I can show you how to do-si-do, I can show you how to scratch a record. I can take apart the remote control, and I can almost put it back together. I can tie a knot in a cherry stem, I can tell you about Leif Erikson. I know all the words to De Colores, and I'm proud to be an American. Me and my friend saw a platypus, me and my friend made a comic book. And guess how long it took, I can do anything that I want, cause look. I can keep rhythm with no metronome, no metronome, no metronome. And I can see your face on the telephone, on the telephone, on the telephone. Look at me, look at me, just called to say that it's good to be alive. In such a small world, I'm all curled up with a book to read. I can make money, open up a thrift store, I can make a living off a magazine. I can design an engine, 64 miles to a gallon of gasoline. I can make new antibiotics, I can make computers survive aquatic conditions. I know how to run a business, and I can make you want to buy a product. Movers, shakers, and producers, me and my friends understand the future. I see the strings that control the system, I can do anything with no resistance. Cause I can lead a nation with a microphone,
with a microphone, with a microphone. And I can split the atom of a molecule, of a molecule, of a molecule. My reach is global, my tower secure, my cause is noble, my power is pure. I can hand out a million vaccinations, so let them all die in exasperation. Have them all healed from the lacerations, have them all killed by assassination. I can make anybody go to prison just because I don't like them. And I can do anything with no permission. I have it all under my command because I can guide a missile by satellite, by satellite, by satellite. And I can hit a target through a telescope, a telescope, through a telescope. And I can end the planet in a holocaust, 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 in a holocaust.
With no handlebars, no handlebars, no handlebars. I can ride my bike with no handlebars, no handlebars, no handlebars.
And now for something completely different.